What's up? Welcome back to the show. It's sequel season, which means all episodes you're hearing right now are follow-ups to episodes we did way back when we were just getting our feet wet in the podcasting biz. I'm your host. I forgot who I was. Wow. It's so weird to be doing Land's job, you know? I'm your host, Saul, and I got really overwhelmed with Land not being here. It's sad he's not here, but it's okay. I'm not by myself. I have Keegan. How are you doing today, Keegan?
I feel like a punky Brewster.
Whoa. I actually don't know what that is. Is that a show? Is that a movie?
Yeah, it's an old show. I don't think I've seen one episode of it. It's like an old latchkey kid show, an old Saturday morning. It has nothing to do with being punk at all, I don't think.
Speaking of being punk at all, this episode is a sequel to My Brother in Punk Rock Christ. That was an episode Lan and I did about two Sean Murphy books. We did his first White Knight, and we did Punk Rock Jesus. Now, I'm a huge Sean Murphy fan. If you listen to the pod, I'm always singing his praises. You know how much I love the guy. But Punk Rock Jesus didn't really hit for me. Go back, listen to the show. You can get our thoughts on it. It's when our audio still kind of sucked, but I really like that episode. My main issue was that this wasn't really a comic about punk, and we'll get into that more later, like what it means for a comic to be about punk. It was more about reality TV and not much going on there under the hood. So we have three new selections today, and we will be looking at all these comics and asking, are they punk? But before we do that, I wanted to ask Keegan, what is your experience with the punk rock scene?
I don't really have much. Like, I think I have enough to know I don't know enough about it. Does that make sense? Like, I'm aware of the scene. I'm aware of, like, kind of the big gestures. And I think I'm more aware of the post-punk thoughts, right? Like, of what punk turned out to be, you know. Like, I think in hindsight, you know, the hippies gave way to old hippies gave way to punk, and then punk gave way to, like, Gen X sellout-ness, right? And it just kind of crumbled. But then, like, punk revival is both of the is like gesturing at why those punk burnouts happened, and also that, like, well, it didn't really go away, and, like, there's the underlying philosophy around punk is still there. So, like, punk as a movement is more a thing I think I understand more than, like, punk art.
So are you saying you describe yourself as a hope punk?
of course, always and forever.
Hope punk till I die.
Yeah.
but on the note of punk, I think it will help to define it soon enough. But is there anything you listen to that could be considered punk or punk adjacent?
I actually recently, I believe you've described it as punk. I wouldn't have been able to, but Spiritual Cramp, I've been listening to that, their new album.
Oh, hell yeah.
A ton. Yeah. Since you recommended it, I was like, oh shit, it's great. It's their new album is awesome too. So, like, yeah. And if, like, again, I feel like a punk sound is less, especially as the years have gone on, it's less defined. So, like, there's probably other punk stuff that I don't even realize that I was listening to that would be considered punk. But recently, yeah, Spiritual Cramp.
Dude, that's so sick. I'm glad you're enjoying the album. I think with Spiritual Cramp, I had to look at a text message there. No more distractions. We're locked in. with Spiritual Cramp, what I love about those guys is they're very open about their influences, but they very much live in the present. And they listen to a bunch of different kinds of music. You know, they talk about their hip-hop influence. One of their members is really in the hip-hop scene. And that, to me, is really punk. I think punk should evolve. And that's something we'll be getting into the show today. It's like, there is this image of punk that we see all the time. The Liberty spikes, all the patches, the mohawks. And like, that's cool. That's a thing. I knew kids like that in high school. But on that note, I haven't seen anyone like that at a punk show since high school. Like, if that's your thing, cool. Right. But punk has taken so many forms. There's so many things that are punk. I don't think you need to be a scholar or an expert on punk and its origins to enjoy it. And like quite the opposite, I think it's something that evolves. You should be in the moment and see what trends are going on. You know, like on that note with hip hop, a lot of hip hop has the punk ethos of that like first punk wave, right? Like the DIY, the values of it. So that's something we'll look at with these comics. My last point I wanted to make is back to the hope punk thing. You saw this with Superman. You see this with like people like Rainn Wilson and his social media accounts. You see stuff like maybe being nice was the most punk rock thing you could do of all. I think you should be nice to people. I think that's pretty uncontroversial. I would not say it's punk though. I think punk is doing things on your own and smelling bad while doing it. That is my definition of punk.
Let's go. That's good. A good definition.
Yeah. Any statements? Any grandstanding you want to do before we get into it?
No. I think anything I've learned about punk through these comics we could talk about in the comics.
Excellent. All right. Well, with all of that out of the way, get your plate, your fork, your knife, get your microwaved can of beans, because we are sitting down for a proper Punksgiving. For our Punksgiving first course, we are moving through this chronologically. Well, actually, let's step back. Let's tell you what there will be to enjoy, what we have on offer. We have three comics for you today. Well, more depending on how you count. But we've got Deadly Class, we've got Spider Punk, and we have Toe Tap Riot. So we'll be looking at these three comics, and we'll go through them chronologically. First course, Deadly Class. This was a comic by Rick Remender for Image Comics. Artist, I am already failing and flailing.
Wes Craig, Lee Luridge, and I think Russ Wooten is the letterer. Let me double check that.
Did you do all that off the top of your head?
Yeah. I did.
That's a powerful autism you got there.
You know, the reason is this book was huge in 2014-ish, you know, like that was the midst of the big Image boom. You know, Remender jumped over to Image. This is really the book that proved to him, I think. One second. Forgot to close the window.
I had a text. He had a window. No more distractions. No,
We're locked in. This proved to Remender, I think, that he could make his money off of indie books or non big two books, because it was a huge success. I think there was probably a period of time there, maybe all the way up into 2020, where anybody who was really locked in on Image, this would have been their like third or fourth favorite Image book. At the time.
Was it your third or fourth favorite book?
I only read the first issue. I read the first issue and I was just like, I don't know why. I think I was just like getting my fill of YA stuff at the time from other Image books.
You hate
books
punk.
More.
I get it. He's like, I hate this punk stuff.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't think it was that either. I think it was just like, I dipped in and then I dipped out. I know I like dipped in again around 3 or 4 because people were freaking out about the acid issue. So like I kind of, and like I never had a fully, I don't have an interest in this book. It was just kind of like not third or fourth, right? It was like lower on the thing. I purchased the trade digitally through Comixology at some point because it was probably like $2 or something. I don't know. There was a version of me that followed this instead of another book. But the noise about it was huge. And then Wes Craig is great. I love his art.
Where else had you seen Wes Craig's art? Because I think he's the strongest part of this book.
Yeah. I actually always forget if he did Gravediggers Union before this or if it was during a break. He took a break, you know, some months long break from Deadly Class to do Gravediggers Union. But now he's doing Kaya, which is more YA, more like all ages, actually, probably. That book's great. It's gorgeous. And then actually, we'll be talking about Wes Craig's art soon enough whenever we do our Absolute stuff, because he did half of the All In issue. So he's around. He's not the fastest guy ever. So, you know, he's only Deadly Class was a long commitment from him. And that was all his art was in for quite some time. So,
but I do fuck like fast artists. All my favorite artists were hella slow.
It's true. So it's fine. Kaya is really good though. So he writes it too, he's fully the cartoonist on that book. And it's fun, like all ages stuff that, is worth the time. So, he's great. I think he grew a lot on this book too, because even back here, he looks a little more sketchy, you know, a little less, his lines are less defined here, but, still, I love him. Yeah. Wes Craig is awesome.
On that note of this being YA, yeah, I was looking at this and yeah, this does really suffer from the YA tropes. I mean, you could definitely call this like Gen X dude Harry Potter it's got a lot of the other YA things going on. It's got like a Hunger Games thing going on. It's it is that fever pitch of YA at that time. You are certainly right.
Yeah, and it's comparable to a lot of other Image stuff. Again, I think that was a big thing of like, I'm reading Paper Girls, I'm reading Saga, like I'm already reading this like YA bullshit. Like, why do I need another one of these things? And like the answer is Wes Craig, but it's also like, yeah, something I had to give.
Well, let's dive into Volume 1 of Deadly Class. Volume 1 is titled Reagan Youth. Like we said already, I think it came out around 2014. Let's start with the we'll do this issue by issue, and you'll see soon enough why it won't take that long to do this issue by issue. If you listen to the show, you know I don't finish things. Who said that? Issue 1, Volume 1. Marcus, our protagonist, is a homeless teenager living on the streets of San Francisco in 1987. Marcus formerly lived in a boy's home, but has since run away to live on the streets. Marcus spends his days pickpocketing and stealing to get by and fighting off bums just to keep all his own shoes. We see a flashback to Marcus's childhood. Marcus's father was a cop who got tricked by Reagan's CIA into trafficking arms to the Contras. The Sandinistas blew up their house and the family relocated to San Francisco. Not long after, a woman jumps off the bridge to kill herself and lands on Marcus's parents, incidentally killing them as well. Marcus gets into... Marcus's life is becoming increasingly miserable in his orphan teenage years. He almost jumps off the bridge to kill himself. Then he decides to live. Marcus goes to the Day of the Dead festival in the Mission to check it out. One of the students from Deadly Class tells him it's a sting, and Marcus runs away from the cops that start chasing him. Various students help Marcus escape, attacking and even killing cops. Marcus, in shock, is blackbagged. He's kidnapped, blindfolded, taken to Deadly Class. Marcus learns the kids that helped him escape are students there, and the headmaster allows Marcus to enroll. If I kept saying they were from Deadly Class or going to Deadly Class, yes, that's the name of the comic. No, that's not the name of the school in the comic, but I felt like calling it that because I don't remember what it was called, and I don't care what it was called. This is a whirlwind of an issue, Keegan. How did we like it?
It's a, I mean, I've read this issue. I've read this issue multiple times because I think I've tried to read this more than once. So it was really familiar. It's a lot, huh? It's a lot of an issue.
So much. We could unpack like even just half a sentence from that synopsis.
Yeah, and this was another trend of those Image books. Everybody was trying to figure out how to do an issue one, right? Because it was like everybody was doing issue ones. I mean, Remender ended up going on in the next decade, writing like seven new series at Image or something like that, a bunch. So, you know, everybody was experimenting with extra page counts and figuring stuff out. But the density of this book, especially, is Wes Craig too, right? Like, there's a lot of 9-panel pages. There's a lot of, I think there's like even a 12-panel page, super high panel count, and you know, there's dialogue in almost every single panel on top of that. And yeah, I guess this is a good part to talk about how wordy this damn thing is. Remender just like has never seen a page that he couldn't put some prose on, huh? Like,
it's a very like 1960s Marvel thing, like Lee getting really insecure about some beautiful Coletta or Kirby art, and just, sorry, not Coletta. Just pretend I said Kirby and something's hard. But you know, he gets very nervous about the good art and like has to put words on it. I'm here too.
It's like an attempt at Hemingway too. It's all very purple prose. Like it's very like I'm a writer. Look at these words I can write. And yeah, it isn't even, I think it's like both what you said and also a thing of like, well, writers have a real job too. It's like, well, yeah, sometimes the writer's job is to get out of the way, man. Which like sometimes it happens, right? And I think that's the book's the best when Craig gets to go wild and put a bunch of cool stuff on the page. But yeah, a lot, and a lot of like journal entry stuff too, that is just like gets old really quickly.
It's overwhelming. It's there, all that prose is there to evoke a time and a place, and I felt like it was really hard to just experience that vibe, as mm-hmm. it were, because it's so much going on. There's all the flashbacking, the dates are changing, the settings are, it's like, for as wordy as it is, for how much as we're explicitly told about Marcus, he was still kind of a cipher to me by the end.
Yeah, it's very much, it's like, this is a visual medium, and it's like I don't want to be told about the characters that much. And I do think like there's a point later on in the volume where his whining becomes his characterization a lot. And like, that's when it finally kind of clicks in place, but you still could have like taken a machete to a lot of this and still had that effect later on, you know? But especially here, it's really overwhelming. And then it also just makes me like, so much of it just slides off my brain. Like it doesn't stick at all.
I had that problem too, and I was trying to figure out why the big chase and with the motorcycle, like why that was hitting so hard. And you know, it's really expertly rendered. I think Craig is doing some really fantastic work with poses, with compositions, with panel layouts. But it's not just that it's good. It's the Remender is actually starting to get out of the way a little bit here. Mm-hmm. And frankly, he could have gotten out of the way even more.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I get like first issues are going to have this kind of issue. You know, you're front loading a lot of stuff. You have all this stuff with Marcus, and then you have all this stuff to all this ground to lay with the school too. Plus it's like, there's a big cast in this. I get why how the series went so long. I think it went over 50 issues. So like, I get how all that kind of happens. And like why as a first issue, this is kind of a slog, but also, I mean, as much as, you know, Remender spent the next decade after this, basically digging himself in more and more at Image and just being like, I can make all my money doing this. I don't know why everybody isn't doing that. It's also a thing of like, he did work in comics for quite some time before this. And so it's a weird thing where this feels more like a rookie mistake, which I guess you don't have to explain Venom's deal on your first issue of Venom. You know, like if you're picking up a Venom comic, you know what's up. So I guess there's that. And this was still a newer thing. But still, yeah, it just kind of reeks of rookie stuff. But art's great. It's still kind of a banger, just based on what Wes Craig is doing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what got me to keep reading.
Oh, but the lady the lady jumping off the bridge to crush his parents is bewildering.
I was about to talk about that.
Okay, so, perfect.
Remender has a very funny politics. It's like kind of a libertarian thing, but it's even more cryptic in trying to decipher. I realize there's kind of a formula to this first issue that you do see continue further in some of the other issues, but it's really clear here where he has to take the biggest swing. We see characters like Marcus, they're exposed to a real world tragedy that is often perpetuated by the far right, but then Remender always makes sure to blame the oppressed party as equally as the right. So if we start with that lady, right? What happened was she jumps off the bridge that Marcus eventually decides to jump off of, but, you know, turns back. But when she jumps off the bridge, the way that panel is done, like, it's like the camera's looking up at her as she's falling. So it's already this, like, crazy dynamic shot. She's flying towards the camera. And Craig and Remender have been very purposeful in perpetrating her as grotesque. Like, she looks like a demon from Evil Dead 2. She's terrifying. Yeah. And the text is explicitly telling you this was a paranoid schizophrenic who was let out onto the street by Reagan's austerity policies, right? We're cutting funding to homeless programs, and now all these people are out on the street. So right there, you see the formula. It's like, all right, this is Reagan's fault, but also, like, homeless people are real scary. So, like, he really wants it both ways. Even before that, though, on that same page, I mean, that double page is a doozy, right? I want to go back to what I said in my synopsis, which is straight out of the book. Marcus's father was a cop who got tricked by Reagan's CIA into trafficking arms to the Contras. Now, that's only half of it. Like, where do you even begin with that? Like, he's a cop who got tricked? Like, what do you mean? Is he a cop in San Francisco? Is he an American cop? Is he a cop from Nicaragua? Like, Marcus is Nicaraguan, but we never learn, like, where the dad is on the beat. Like, you're making his dad sound really dumb for being tricked to getting to work for Reagan.
Yeah.
But then...
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, it's that the follow-up is then the Sandinistas blew up their house, right? And, dude, I'm not an expert on Iran-Contra. It's a really dense event, but if you look at just what he's saying here textually and metatextually, it's like, hey, look, there's bad people on both sides. But that doesn't even agree with the book's overall arc. The book lays it out in issue one. Marcus is going to kill Reagan. Whether or not he achieves that by the end, I don't know, but that is his goal. He states it over and over. But he wants it both ways. Reagan's a bad guy, but those wily leftists, those people who didn't want their country turned into a shooting range for Reagan, you know, they got some sins to account for as well. So I that was really what was impressed upon me with this first issue.
Yeah, I mean, it is important to note that Remender is a dumb guy who makes comics for dumb guys. Okay, like, and, you know, we talked a little bit about this about Snyder, and honestly, I'm not as, like, Remender stuff, I haven't dug in as much, right? Uncanny X-Force is one of the best comics of the decade. At Marvel, like, that book is an incredible X-Men comic. Maybe the only X-Men comic I would tell people to read. Maybe the only good Deadpool that's ever been written. Like, it's a really good comic. Looks beautiful. And then Remender went on to like take so many of the things that he learned from that and what he was saying with that, and was like, I'm going to say this over and over again over at Image. And like, it's been incredibly successful for him. Like, people are big fans of his stuff. But it really, this is like, he knew
Keegan's been staggered. He's taking stagger damage. Yeah.
No, like I think all he's trying to say actually with this book is that like Reagan bad, right? This is no different than Orange Man bad stuff. But yeah, like I don't, bewildering choices, and like not even in a way, right? With Undiscovered Country, I'm like, some of these things I can see addressed. I can see these as seeds that were planted in order for them to be able to address, like the reporter stuff, especially. Like, I can see that as 20 issues down the line, they're like, actually, the reporter is the worst character in this book, right? I can see that. That's playing in similar stuff that other books were doing at Image at the time. But like, his dad, the cop stuff with his dad, there's nothing, I don't think there's rich coming back to that. Right. Like, I don't,
I think that needed like its own issue, and you should have done it in this first arc. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, do that in issue 4 or whatever.
It's
like,
so confusing.
Maybe it comes later, but you can't just like throw all that out there and not like elaborate.
Yeah. And it's like, there's no, it's so weird to put all that detail there. And maybe it is, I guess, you know, with that amount of detail, maybe it is a thing that will be returned to. Because like, there's other stuff here that I think, you know, could be expanded on and explained like down the line. But that is such, it's so bizarre. And like, again, you know, it's this thing of like, Remender wants to make all of these connections to Reagan making the world worse. And it's like, yeah, that's okay, cool. That's great. I'm happy to hear that. But like, what an insane way to kill the main character's parents. Like, just doesn't, there's no, they could have blown up in the house explosion. Like, it's so weird. Yeah. It seems so superfluous.
Superfluosity is maybe the issue, because it's less than I'm tutting the politics here, but more like, all right, you're going out of the way to say, like, you know, to do this both sides,
adding
like,
stuff then doesn't, you should need to be there.
Yeah. If that all, if you're insisting on it being there, elaborate. You know,
Iran Contra is insane to bring up at all.
I know, dude.
It has no, like, it's just another Orange Man bad kind of thing. Like, or
I mean,
whatever.
Hey, if Marcus has to do a hit on Ollie North, then I will finish this series.
I mean, like, it's weird, man. It's very weird that that's even a sentence, and then it's only one sentence. Like, it's what? It's really wild.
There are other things like that in this book. Like, one sentence things. It's like, what, dude?
Huh? Why are we talking about this?
Yeah. Oh, that'll come up very soon. One more thing in this first issue that I think kind of plagues the whole comic is the final double page splash when Marcus is brought by the headmaster to Deadly Class. It's this like giant Hogwarts type school in some very subterranean cavern.
Yes. Okay.
And dog, we got to talk about this. This is one of the craziest things you can do, because first of all, we are in San Francisco, all right? This is earthquake capital USA and gay sex capital USA. But
those,
that's another
two
thing. but the audacity to put like this school underneath this unstable fault line. How do I put this? This book, they talk about in the back matter, and it also wants to speak for itself, that it's like this really gritty, realistic thing. And some of it is. There is like a good deal of historical research. I like a lot of the realistic stuff going on here. But My biggest problem with this book, man, is the way the fantasy YA stuff clashes with the gritty real world stuff. And that was the most jarring thing to continue into this book. Like, wait, you want to do what, dog? You want to have an underground, like, 40-acre estate underneath San Francisco, and you're not going to talk about, like, how you did that? What?
Yeah, and, you know, I've talked about this before. My favorite thing I've stolen from Austin Walker is that, like, well, there's, like, four things happening here, actually, where it's like, well, one, why do you do YA, right? Why do you do YA? It's to cast a wide net, right?
Money!
Yeah, exactly. It's money. And then it's also that, like, everybody just, we intuitively at this point know the YA tropes, which means it's easier for the average reader to, like, glom onto things and get what you're going for, so that you could be a little more complex, right? Okay. It's not really doing that here, I don't think. It's pretty straightforward on that front. But then the problem is when you have somebody who, like, most of us are consuming a lot of art, like, all the time. We're constantly reading, watching, interacting with things through TikTok, whatever. And so it's like, we are the cinemasins thing of, like, why is there a mansion under San Francisco? You make that more easy to lock onto when you do the YA thing, because it's easier for us to figure out everything else. So then it's like, this looks really stupid, dude. Like, why are you doing such a dumb thing? And yeah, no, like, it's one of those things, especially hitting the last note of the first issue on a subterranean San Franciscan estate is like, why? Yeah, I don't.
And to be clear, like, I can enjoy a big swing, but it's the tropiness of it, right? Like, mm-hmm, we exactly. need to have a secret school because we gotta, you know, that's our checklist for YA. I love the big dick move of, like, I'm gonna explain this in one sentence, you know, like, you can just do some pseudoscience and
we put it here because whenever there's an earthquake, it'll get destroyed and we can relocate easily, right? Like,
beautiful.
This is a temporary thing and we're a bunch of assassins. We move around. Like, there's the explanation. And maybe, like, again, like we talked about in the last recording, I'm like, let me have an imagination when I'm working with your thing, right? Like, that's fun. Yeah. No prizes are fun, but it also doesn't invite that. It doesn't, like, encourage that or anything. It's just subterranean San Francisco mansion. And it's like, what a choice.
Yeah. Crazy. All right. We're going to get into issue two. We start with a flashback in the boys' home that Marcus ran away from. Then we come back to the present day. The headmaster is elaborating more on the rules of the school, the expectations. Marcus then starts touring the grounds on his first day of school. He meets all the various students. He gets some hazing. Someone accuses him of being a child killer with a doll with a knife in it in his locker. Before I continue, did you know what that was? Did I miss something?
Oh, I mean, they reveal it later.
Oh, right. We'll get into that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
So there's the child killer thing. Then we go to the first day of class in a very Harry Potter-style montage where he's in, like, the beheadings class, the poisons class, et cetera, et cetera. Marcus goes out behind the school to do his punk rock thing of getting high with the outcasts. We then see some bullying from another kid and a very Ender's Game style moment where the Russian kid is picking on another kid, and, like, Marcus steps up to defend the kid, but the other kid craps himself, which kind of diffuses the whole situation. The bullied kid, I mean. We then meet the various cliques of the school. We have the preps, they're kids of the CIA and the feds, the Dixie Mob. This is all, like, you know, Southern white pride style stuff. Soto Vatos, these are the kids of cartels in California and Central America. The Jersey Kings, this is clearly the Italian mobbed up group. The FWO, Final World Order, these are the blacks, because they're not really given much more characterization beside that. It's We'll get into the it's racial politics.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And then we also have the Kuroki Syndicate, which are the kids of the Yakuza. Then Marcus and his friends are given their first assignment. They have to go kill a vagrant. Also, that last class is called Black Arts, which is just, you are not discouraging the Harry Potter comparison,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah. It's funny because I have a friend who's still like into Harry Potter, like not, you know, guiltily, basically. But even then, I don't even, it's like so beyond Harry Potter in my mind, but this is so directly Harry Potter. Like, it's not even, like, it's not even just generic YA, you know?
It's just very like, clear what the blueprint is.
Yeah, man.
Any threads you want to start with in this issue?
Oh, I mean, this is really dense. It's also really, like, on its face. But... No boner is naturally this size.
Right. So that's when Marcus is, you know, standing up to the Russian bully and saying, like, hey, why are you hard when you're picking on this kid? And it's one of those, it's a little bit like the info dump with the dad. Like, why is that in here, dude? Like, why, what is this adding to the situation?
Yeah,
it's a very Gen X thing, I would say, to be controversial for the sake of controversial. Like, whoa, am I freaking you out? That's kind of how Remender feels to me in this scene.
It's like a cuck thing kind of too, you know? Like Marcus is confronting the bully and the bully's hung is like, oh, what are you working through, Rick? What are we...
Speaking of what Rick is working through in edgy material, this issue starts with that flashback we alluded to with Marcus in the home, and Rick is really sure to make sure you understand that Marcus's roommate is jacking himself off watching like a dog competition show on TV, and the kid alludes to the fact that he would molest his own dog, which is what led to him being put in this home. And it's just gross, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think there's people who know how to handle like really depraved crime stuff, and like there's a reason for it being here. But this just comes off as, again, aren't I edgy? And it's not the only time it happens. We're in the next issue, we're gonna see that the main villain also molests animals. It's
vile. I think this isn't a reveal or anything, but that's the same guy though, right?
Oh, that would make sense. I didn't finish it.
He's obsessed. He's obsessed with this making this guy talk about how he molests animals,
it feels very it's like those, it reminds me of those t-shirts that like right wingers wear that say like kill your local pedophile. Dude, I think people who hurt children or animals are bad, but like,
why do we gotta,
I'm
talk
not gonna make
about
my personality
them? Like, why are we always really talking weird about this? This guy's only bringing up that he molests animals all the time. It's really weird of him. It's like, you don't have to, like, thanks for making it really clear he's the bad guy. But like,
No, that's what it is, though, right? It's that economy of like, I bet you hate this guy now.
And also, it's a thing of like, I can't tell. I'm thankful because I can't really tell who he's saying are the bad guys a lot of the time, because he's like, his dad's a cop. It's like, well, that means he's a bad guy. Well, he was one of the good ones. He was tricked into Iran-Contra.
Yeah,
it's like, I don't know, man. I don't know.
Dude, there is so much about the cop politics I can't even get into just for time. But yeah, this book has crazy politics on cops. Yeah. We'll just say that. Yeah. I do want to get into the race stuff a little more here. How do I put this? I think if you're a white dude writer, yeah, you should write what you want. Like, I don't think any type of person or their experience is off limits. But there is a dicey situation that I've seen white writers put themselves into sometimes, where it can feel a little bit like exoticizing or fetishizing women of other cultures. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, I'm not trying to be a care lord or you know, say that like I'm an expert on this, but it's a little bit like, it feels weird. I know it when I see it. And like, you know, I think Ramon Villalobos was pointing out that why the Latina assassin gotta have the Day of the Dead makeup on half the time.
Yeah.
Like that's a little weird. That's a little corny, but it's not just that. It's that Marcus is in this sort of love triangle with her and the Japanese girl who's got the Yakuza tattoos.
Yeah. And she has like, she has like white face makeup too, right? During part of
it? Oh, like a geisha style thing? Probably.
Yeah, doesn't she? I think she does. Maybe
I wouldn't be surprised. But I think it's just this othering of these women, like, you know, like you've already told me they're assassins, they're child assassins, their lives are crazy. Like, I think maybe the way he could have avoided that was like perhaps having like not something dancing on the edge of a stereotype.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, part of it is like it's well intentioned almost, because it's like, look at the cast. The cast is like it's not all white people, right?
Right.
And I mean, this was also, again, the image boom. So much of it was about selling your stuff to be optioned for television. Now, again, a lot of that image boom stuff was like these are comics as comics, right? Like Wes Craig worked the shit out of this book. So I'm not saying this book was only created as a TV pitch, but also like it's cool. It's cool that he wrote a book that was obviously going to be optioned, right? That he wrote for years so that there would be years of television that could be made off of it. And like that he also made it super multicultural. That stuff's cool, but it's cool if you could pull it off. And in a TV series, the reason a white dude can show run that is because there's a writer's room who can sand some of that stuff off. Is not great politics off.
Did
to
you
figure
watch
out how
the
it
show?
Works. I did not.
Okay.
Again,
yeah, me
I
neither.
Didn't,
I can't.
I only read the first issue, so like, why was I going to watch the first season? Yeah, and I mean, by all accounts, the canceling of the show was not good for his brain. But like, yeah, I mean, it ain't good. It ain't good. I don't know that it's, you know, outwardly. I mean, it's ignorant on some level, right? But I mean, a lot of comics are, because
we can say it's distracting, right? It doesn't feel natural. I'm not trying to call this guy a racist. That's not it's not what I'm going for here. It's just it's just one of those things that dates the book.
Yeah, and it's noticeable for sure.
Yeah. All right, third issue. This one we're gonna get through real quick. What was his buddy's name? The kid he hangs out with here.
I can't remember, honestly. I'm seeing if I can.
All right. Well, this Marcus, like we alluded to, this issue primarily focuses on him having to go out and do the hit. He's got to go kill a vagrant. He's got to kill a specific one. So this issue will primarily concern him going out with another kid to do so. Before we do that, we do get the reveal of a cop confronting some guy at a farm who is, there was a report of a disturbance and the guy is molesting the goats. So now I get to see that. The cop gets killed by the guy, and we get our villain reveal. Keegan says it was probably the kid that Marcus went to school with, and thinking about the scars on this guy's face and what we learn later, that probably makes sense. There's a lot of running across rooftops, some great action from Craig here. He's got a really good sense of you know, poses and movement. I really like the stuff on the buses and the bus stops. I strongly relate to that. The colors are really evocative of those late San Francisco nights. This issue, there's like two main reveals. We get his buddy is caught in a lie. Willie says he killed like a bunch of gangbangers who broke into his house when he's a kid, and it turns out his dad or his uncle covered for him. And then there's everything with the bums. Willie and Marcus catch up with the main bum. They kind of chicken out. They can't pull the trigger. I don't remember why they had to kill him. Doesn't matter. They wander around for a little bit. Then they catch up with a different bum at his camp, and the guy offers him some food. There is the reveal on these final pages when the bum calls Marcus a pretty boy based on the panels. You can tell me if I interpreted this wrong. This seems to reveal this uncovered memory, or it unlocks a memory for Marcus, and that this bum used to molest Marcus. So Marcus then grabs a blunt object, kills this bum, and Willie's kind of horrified at Marcus's killer instinct. End of the issue. Did I miss anything?
No. I like your read. That's good. You know, I think more of the bizarre politics of this book rears its head here with the...
go off.
Because, like, okay, it's like the whole Vietnam thing, right? Like, you'd expect somebody who has the... And not Marcus, right? And I think some of this is muddied by the fact that, like, this is a book about a child and a child's politics also that the book can hide behind. Right.
It's a good point. Yeah.
Because like you know, you would think a writer writing about Reagan America, hey, this book hates Reagan. Right. And you would think that same opinion would translate over to Vietnam. And like for Marcus, it does. Right. Like textually, the reason he's like, okay, we can kill this guy is because he's like, yeah, we killed a bunch of kids and stuff in Vietnam. But like, I mean, I don't know. I don't even think the book is terrible in terms of, I mean, like the whole go out and kill a homeless person is horrible, right? Like go out and find a homeless person who's committed a crime.
Well, it's a baffling style of world building, right? Because this is a private, let me back up. This is a secret private institution, the Deadly Class.
Right, right.
And... They're sending these assassin proteges to kill homeless people. Like, they allude to the fact that they're gonna kill powerful people, but like, again, it doesn't need to be like perfect world building. But I would like a little bit more indication of like how the money is moving, you know, like what's propping all this up. Like just going out and killing homeless people is like weirdly sadistic, especially in light of Remender adding the little bit of like how the teachers don't want to raise psychopaths, right? They make that clear. They say like, hey, you know, we found out that a lot of the best assassins aren't like total nutcases. So it's like, well, I think it's pretty antisocial to like go out and kill homeless people even if they've committed crimes. But like, again, I think you said it perfectly. It's like Remender is hiding behind the politics of a child's politics, like or a child's perception of the world. It's so baffling, dude.
Yeah. No, I mean, and like... Yeah, I guess it's coherent to some degree of like, okay, I hate Reagan. This guy mentions Vietnam. I'm going to kill this guy. And like even within the book, it's like it's not. I think you're supposed to feel icky, right? That they're like sent out to kill homeless people, and then he kills this homeless man that was at least friendly with him. Maybe he was molesting him. And again, that's a pretty good read, I think, on like the actual what's going on in that scene. So like, I think you are supposed to feel gross about all of it. But I don't know. It doesn't, I don't think it lands the way it wants to land.
I had the opposite problem, is that I felt like it wanted to be justified, or it didn't want me to feel too gross, right? Like by adding the reveal that the homeless man has molested Marcus, you don't have to feel too bad about the fact that a 17-year-old has killed a homeless man in cold blood.
Yeah.
Right?
It seems like a very tidy way to
deal with any ambiguity here, right?
Right, right. And it feels like it tries to do that balance where it's like, well, it was justified, but also like, it's weird that these kids are being sent out to kill homeless people. Like, I think there's supposed to be a quality of that. It's not questioned. Well, it is questioned. Like, it's questioned pretty directly of him being like, are they just trying to fuck with me? Is this just like, are they just trying to remind me where I came from and where I could be? Which, like, it's fine. But I think the other, like, this is a fun issue visually. But again, I think it's the same issue as issue one. Like, there's a lot of text on the page for little reason, and it slows things down so much because it's like just taking a quick count, you flip through these pages and it's like very rarely is it below 8 panels. Sometimes it's up to 12.
And if the you have panels balloons, are panel count is so high that a lot of the panels have to be small, and like that can be effective occasionally, but most of the book feels like that, right? It feels very cramped a lot of the time.
Yeah, and there's a lot, there's like word balloons in every panel almost too. That just like slows down the whole thing. And like, I don't know, I think if this issue had a little more room to breathe, maybe it could have been more effective in the end, but maybe not. It's a whole thing of just like, I also think like you're really thrown into this thing, right? Like issue three is the first assassination, and it's a hobo assassination where they're also being tracked down by his enemy whose face he blew up. Like, that's right, crazy.
Speaking of the face blowing up, the fourth issue opens with the reveal that Marcus is an unreliable narrator of sorts, or at least to himself. We get the reveal that Marcus burned down the school he ran away from. When he's being questioned by cops. We also get that confirmed with like a flashback of Marcus's hands all burnt. Very teenage thing to do, I guess. Try to burn down a school and burn yourself. Most of this issue involves running away from school because Marcus was in solitary for killing the wrong hobo. They go to Vegas and they score drugs and they do acid. I don't have a lot of details here because I kind of checked out. Like, there was not enough working for me here. I think everything you talked about, the denseness of the prose, there's too much going on in some places, not enough in the others. The try-hardness of it really, I didn't like. I didn't think it was adding anything with all this fixation on molesting children and animals. What wasn't good enough to warrant that, I should say. So yeah, this is where I pretty much checked out.
And one more for the record book, comics that Salt wouldn't finish.
Yep.
Throw it in the pile. No, I thought about it. I was like,
you were tempted.
But I mean, I really do. I really like Wes Craig's art, and I don't know. I don't know that I would read more of this, or if I would skim more of this to see how the quality of the line art changes. But the other thing that I think the like long tail of this book is figuring out how it's punk. Right?
Because like that is how we finish this. Yes, that's a perfect segue. Is this punk?
This book, I don't think this volume, I don't think is punk. And I think one of the main ones is like a thing that people, I feel like people get this wrong. I don't know that this is true. I haven't encountered an actual human. I'm making people up. This guy has too many keys on his keyring or whatever the drill tweet is. But I think a lot of people, especially like Gen Xers who got to see punk and hipster, start to conflate those two things. And this book is way, like Marcus himself is way more hipster than he is punk. He's way more like...
Elaborate on that.
So, and I think I was thinking about this a lot for this episode. Like hipster is kind of like, it's ideological. It's ideologically empty punk, where hipsterism is like not liking the popular things because they're popular, right? It's about liking the second most popular thing more than the most popular thing just because it's the second most popular thing. It's about being like hyper self-conscious of all of that stuff, of your style, hyper self-conscious, but not like having actual taste, right? It's about being like, oh, well, I want to like this because it's cool, but it doesn't actually matter if you like it or not, right? And that's so much what Marcus is in this book, right? Because he's a kid. He doesn't know what he likes yet, and he's terrified of liking the wrong thing. He's terrified of liking the wrong person and everything like that. And it's pretty like honest and kind of good that in that way. Like eventually you get further into the book, and especially after like the acid stuff, it's like, okay, this is kind of hitting. Like this is kind of working for me. But it's like, it's empty of all the like punkness that it could be. And that's kind of my read on this, is that it doesn't have the ideology. Like I read this in the opposite order of how we're covering it today. So I read Spider-Punk, then I read Toe Tag Riot, and then I read this. And like Toe Tag Riot has punkness in it, you know, and not just the stuff that people talk about, like, you know, the little quips about punk, but like it feels like it actually has ideology, but this doesn't. This feels like it has no actual beliefs. It just has like oppositional beliefs.
I think this is going to be the only, or this will be the main place we disagree.
Okay.
I find this book to be extremely punk. It's actually one of the most punk books I have ever read, like comic books. But that is not a compliment. This is punk for better and for worse, and I'm going to really emphasize the worst. Like, if you want to come at punk and criticize punk as a movement, as a culture, as how it affected people, and like all the ways punk fails and punk is hypocritical, I think this book really embodies that. You know, when I look at the... Did you read the back matter? Remembers?
Not really.
So he writes a little blurb at the end. And it's pretty affecting. You know, he talks about his childhood, like how he grew up. He talks about moving around a lot and living in Arizona and like what it was like in the 80s. He talks about like kids getting addicted to drugs, kids dying of gun violence, right in front of him. Like, you know, his little crew of freaks, like that is sufficiently punk, you know, like the way he describes it. I fully believe all that. And I do see a lot of that in this book. I do see a lot of these punk rock experiences, but like everything we've said that I did not enjoy about this book, or that you did not enjoy about this book, like that also adds up to its punkness, right? Like I think the baffling politics of it all, the selloutness of it all, that you put it all together, this is a very punk book to me.
Okay. See, and oh, here's the thing. You're the punk expert, so I'm just wrong. There's no disagreement here. But I also think like you having experienced punk more, like I think I have an idea of what punk is based on like even the whole punk stuff of how people talk about punk, right? And there's like a purity of ideology to a lot of people of what punk is, but you're just like, no, that's wrong, like isn't true. And there's a lot of really stupid punk fans, and it's almost like punk is your Star Wars salt, where I'm just like, no, Star Wars is stupid and I love it, but like Star Wars is stupid and everybody who likes Star Wars is stupid, and like,
oh, that's how I feel about punk about it.
Exactly. And I think that's just how this is. And I was like, okay, like I can totally, I get it. It's like, okay, that clicks. So in that way it's like, yeah, you're just right. Which also is to say, like, hipsterism is also a mutation of punkism.
Absolutely.
Punk, right.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it is that stuff too. So like being a hipster is punk also, which makes sense. Yeah. So I get it. Yeah. You're just right. Congrats on being the smart guy here.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I guess the only thing I'll say in response to punk expert is, like, there is so much I don't know about, like, you know, 70s and 80s punk. I barely know the Clash, like, but I don't pretend to know about that, right? Like, I like the punk that's happening here and now, and, like, that's my thing, right? And I think it should be what you want it to be, and I think it's about, like, going out, going to the shows, the DIY thing, like, that's what punk is. But you know, I am very aware of the Gen X punk guy, mm-hmm. and Remender is kind of, like, their king, and so, or at least their poster boy, right?
Yeah. No, he's there, and he's enjoying it.
Yeah. Anything else you wanted to say about Deadly Class?
Nah. All right.
Didn't hate this. Didn't like it. But you know, the art is so cool.
I'm catching up on Kaya because of this. Like, I will be reading that book more.
Yeah, we could do it for the pod sometime, because I'd love to look at Craig's art more.
Yeah. Sweet.
Cool. Well, that was our first course at the dinner table. Hope you got more room in your belly. Here's the thing about this pod. I think we have an idea of something to read, and then Keegan is a sadist and adds so much more. So this guy, I thought we would do one issue of Spider-Punk, and he sneakily made us read three different Spider-Punk things.
That was Lance's fault. So, also, I only read two of these, so I just included the other one. But that was Lance's fault. That was not my fault.
All right. Blame it on the absent guy.
Yeah. We should. Never admit okay, anything.
That's fair. Yeah, we'll get through these fairly quick. I don't think we read the debut issue of Spider-Punk, because I think you guys said he's just mainly, like, hanging out in the background. But we read, like, some of the first stories that they gave him, like his own origin. So this first one is called Spider-Verse 2. It's published in 2015. There was multiple shorts in here. I did not read the other ones. I just read the Spider-Punk one. The Spider-Punk story is titled, With Great Power Comes No Future, written by Jed McKay with art by Sheldon Vell. I don't know if I said that name wrong. The synopsis is very easy. This is only a few pages long. There's a President Donald Osborn with his Venom soldiers. He's closing in on Spider-Punk. Spider-Punk, along with Captain Anarchy and a bunch of anarchists, they kill the president and the cops. That's it. It's like, it's four pages long. How'd you like this one?
This is similar to the Elvis short for me. From Department of Truth, which is like, this isn't enough, you know, like,
no,
there's ideas here. There's cool stuff. Like, I like a lot the Venomous Cops is cool. And then like it feels very crafted around one idea of, yeah. Okay, well, Spider-Punk, he's going to play the guitar. He's going to have, like, this crazy loud electrical guitar. So who's going to be the villain? Oh, Venom, of course. And Venom's also going to be cops. Like, that's cool. And Captain Anarchy even is, like, a little too twee, but, like, yeah, it's cool. Like,
that okay. Really seemed like your thing. That was, yeah. What I noted. I'm like, damn, that's such a Keegan character, but maybe too much a Keegan character.
Exactly.
Like, wants
exactly.
Too much to impress you.
You're aiming at me. Stop it. I'm a hipster. Like, I don't want this. But everything's wrapped around that one idea. And it's like, okay, that's fine, but it's so nothing. The art's even cool. Like, the aesthetic is cool for what they're doing, but it's like, this is five issues and it's not
five pages,
yeah, and it's not, like, good. It's just the cool ideas, fine. It's as good as a thing like this could be, maybe.
I would double down on that comment. I would say this is the most depth and length one could or should hope for from a Spider-Punk story.
Yeah.
We'll look at this further with the other issues, but, you know, to put it all out there, for me, is this punk? No, I don't think Spider-Punk is a punk concept. I think he's anti-punk, and I'm not defending punk. I said all the things I think suck about punk as well, but, like, you know, punk, it can be DIY. It can be DIY and work its way up to selling out, but it cannot go the other way. You cannot start at corporate and work your way into some kind of punk cred. Like,
Yeah.
I hate this because I like the art. It reminds me of James Stokoe, which is awesome. But like, there's nothing else you can do with this character. So the fact that this was so short, it's like, fine, this is fun. Whatever. It's not punk, but I like it.
Yeah. It almost wraps back around. Wait, well, I lost my thought. Oh, yeah. It's like, it's the perfect definition of like what Gen X punk became, but like, yeah. It doesn't have the full arc. So yeah, I get why it's just like, this doesn't even make sense to be punk at all. Like it's just purely punk aesthetics, which, yeah, I mean, it's fine. It's fine out of as a 5-pager thing.
Speaking of that, the next issue is Edge of Spider-Geddon. This is written by McKay again, now with art by Gerardo Sandoval. This was published in 2018. This is one 22-page issue. Spider-Punk kicks white supremacist Thunderstrike's butt. Kang shows up, kills Thunderstrike, claims that he's going to bring Spider-Punk to the 2099 level, I mean, universe. Spider-Punk zips around the city until he can convince his friend Robbie to help him. Robbie listens to a cassette that Hobie, aka Spider-Punk, gave him, and Robbie is revealed to be none other than Bruce Robert Banner. Turns into the Hulk. Hulk whoops Kang's ass. Kang goes back to wherever. Then a spider lady shows up and tells Spider-Punk it's time to start a new side quest. How do we like this one?
I did not care for this one. It was too long.
Yeah, there's a lot that does not work here. I think that the mission statement of this one is already kind of...
stupid,
self-defeating. It's that classic thing of like, I'm a writer, I work for the Disney behemoth, I'm going to address that. I'm gonna have a very thinly veiled villain who represents Disney, and our protagonist Spider-Punk is a stand-in for me grappling with my moral dilemma.
Yeah, and that has grown so thin. Like, I don't think this would have hit in 2015 or whenever it was published. 2018, it definitely wouldn't have hit. Yeah. But, like, Barbie came out since then even. So it's just like, no. Nah, this doesn't work.
Here's the way I pose it to you. Why did Ewing's similar Thor issue work for you and this one didn't? Because I mean, if you listen to the show, we did a Thor read-through. And there's a similar issue from Ewing. And
I have similar... I have similar problems with that arc, I think. Partly because Ewing's already done that. So it's not, it's like, okay, it's already been done by him and other people better than it was in Immortal Thor. But I also think the Roxxon issue, which again, we covered in the episode, but I talked about how, it's very much not being, it's not seriously pitching itself as an argument against capitalism. You know, it's like very, it's more, it's just as much playing at joking at Ewing being a part of all of it as it is blaming problems on the Minotaur and stuff like that. And I also, I mean, like the other problem with this issue is like, it's so weird. It's like a sequel of the 5-pager while also being a prelude to whatever Spider-Punk gets up to in Spider-Geddon. And like, how can you possibly pitch any kind of anti-capitalist thing when you exist between that, between a 5-pager that was tied into Spider-Verse and a book called Spider-Geddon? Like, we can't do this. I can't take this seriously at all.
It's the same problems as that short story we wrote, but it's just magnified by being part of an even bigger corporate crossover.
Yeah. And so it's just and it has the complication of, as a story, making that 5-pager more complicated.
Yeah,
and like trying to this entire world that McKay invented for a 5-pager is now supposed to inhabit 22 pages. It doesn't work. It just doesn't like it's there wasn't enough there to tell more story.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's just blah.
I thought Kang the Conglomerator was a clever spin on Kang the Conqueror, and because I am easy to win over, I was actually sympathetic to this issue for a while. But I realized at the end, like, what a farce it was, because, you know, if you want to do this whole, like, guilt trip, am I working for the bad guys type thing, I think you've already set yourself up for likely failure, because you already took the paycheck, you're selling the product to me, like, mm-hmm. Do you think I'm an idiot? Like, yeah, what's going yeah. on here? But a clever enough writer might be able to do something with it, and I don't even dislike McKay. I would be willing to read his other work, but I think this is really, really smooth-brained, because if you look at what happens, we're set up with the moral dilemma of, like, Spider-Punk has to fight corporate overlords. Well, how are you going to resolve this concept? How are you going to defeat, or at the very least resist, capitalism? Let's just get the Hulk to punch it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. That's how this ends. We just get a Hulk and he starts punching.
Like, I think Hulk showing up was the point where I was just like, man.
Oh, you got nothing here. You just got the biggest fist.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, I mean, this would have been, I think, while Immortal Hulk was ongoing. So, like, maybe McKay was looking over at that and going, like, yeah, that's cool, and wanted to do Hulk. But it's just like, Captain Anarchy makes sense. Captain Anarchy, yeah, like, makes sense as a manipulation of the idea. What is Punk Hulk? What is Anarchist Hulk? What do you mean? What does that mean? Well, it's just...
Dear reader, if you're wondering about Anarchist Hulk, and I told you he had tattoos, would you be shocked if he has the character creator tattoos from your favorite video game? Just the random, like, Anarchy A and just all that that nonsense. And he has a mohawk, of course. Yeah. I think it's a good segue into our last Spider-Man story. This is Spider-Punk, Battle of the Band. This is a mini written by Cody Ziegler, art by Justin Mason, and Jim Charlampidis, some Greek name. He did color. By the way, art was great on the last one. I thought yeah. there were some really dynamic poses, some very good riffing on McFarlane style stuff. The art is also pretty good here as well. I don't have any issue with art, and I am picky about art. So I think everything we covered today had good art so far. This one, I think I checked out the earliest, and it's because of its relationship to the last one. I think what you said, it made sense to have, like, a Captain Anarchy. Adding in the Hulk is, like, what are we doing? And, like, this is a 5-issue mini, and the whole thing just feels like an excuse to broaden the portfolio. Okay, well, we need a punk version of Iron Man. We need a mm-hmm. punk version mm-hmm. of Daredevil. And it's just, it's so exhausting, yeah, man. I think I made it an issue and a half and I just tapped out.
I've read the first issue when it came out. I did not. I kind of forgot that I included this anywhere to be read. I'm curious about this as a thing, because it's, I mean, like, he got another mini after this. They got another mini, right?
Wow, so the people demand more Spider-Punk.
People were, I mean, this book sold crazy, too. I remember it sold out of my LCS before I even got there.
You're just feeding my misanthropy by telling me this.
It's crazy.
I'm losing more faith in you, man.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. This was really popular, and it was like, It launched with Spider-Verse 2, so, like, it was timed, right? They were planning that. But yeah, I mean, especially after I read the other two, I was like, there's not gonna be better punk stuff in a mini. But, like, I do, this is just a problem Marvel and DC, anytime they make, this is more of a Marvel thing with their multiverse stuff, where they, like, yeah, they want to cash in on it so crazy, and, like, I don't know. I wish more of it was, like, I don't even know. I just wish there was more thought into it, I guess. Like, It doesn't.
It's what you said. It's a cash in. It's a very predictable formula. All right. So we have, what if this character was a pirate? Well, now we're going to show you all the characters as pirates, right? We're going to make sure every that whenever we release our next. And whenever we release our next video game featuring this character, you'll be sure that you can get a downloadable skin of them in their pirate costume, or we'll give you the Funko Pop of it. I am a bit of a return guy in that I think old multiverse stuff is fun, and not that it's less cynical, but the formula wasn't so rote, right? Now it's just, it's so exhausting because you know how it'll go every time.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. My only other note for this is I knew this was going to suck when we get to Spider-Punk's lair. He's got a poster on his wall that says Punk Rules with a Z.
Yes, of course. Hey, man, Punk Rules, you know?
Punk Rules. So that was Spider-Punk. I decree, no, this was not punk at all.
Not punk at all.
Not punk at all. All right. So we've got one punk and one not punk at all. We have one more meal for you at this Punksgiving. Shake grandma awake. Not too hard. Just make sure, you know, she hasn't passed out. She's got to eat too. This is called Toe Tag Riot. Toe Tag Riot was published with Black Mask. Did you get the year on this? Oh, this was 2014. I didn't do this chronologically. I'm sorry. Don't unsub. Just yell at me online. That's acceptable. This was written by Matt Miner and Sean Von Gorman with pencils. Okay, so they kind of... I see. Sean did the pencils and colors by a guy named John Roch. Letters also by Sean. I'm going to read the press release for this because I think that's a more effective way to do it. This is a hilarious and gory tongue-in-cheek story. Toe Tag Riot is a punk rock band cursed to become zombies whenever they perform their music. The band goes on a cross-country tour in search of a cure, but being the ethical, sometimes zombie punks they are, excuse me, there's my trademark sneeze cough for you. Toe Tag Riot uses their zombie superpowers to rid the world of racists, homophobes, misogynists, and all kinds of other nasty people. Read the LGBTQ positive book that the Westboro Baptist Church themselves accidentally endorsed and then felt really stupid about doing. Guest appearance by Andy Hurley from Fall Out Boy. How did you like this, Keegan?
This is pretty fun. This is a pretty fun comic, I thought. I mean, it's weird. Black Mask had some heaters for a bit, or had some heat for a bit, and published some heaters. So it's kind of highly variable. Sometimes it's like total trash, and sometimes it's like, okay, that was a fun little comic. But, you know, I had no idea what to expect out of it. I don't know. I think it's like a fun, you know, three out of five lettered box with a heart, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's tough. It's like if I personally knew the people who did this, I would probably be very sympathetic. I do appreciate that it is sufficiently DIY. I couldn't get into it. I do mostly like Sean's art. I think it feels like the art you'd see on a punk poster. That's cool. I think this is maybe where I felt a little distance from it is it feels a little too eager to impress upon me it's like progressive bona fides.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's very,
Oh, it's so woke. It's so woke, yeah, it's like immediately. It's extremely woke.
Yeah. I mean, there's a character in here.
You mean the blue haired lesbian with one arm?
Oh yeah. So, our band is made of four people. We got the two cishet white guys, and then it feels a little bit like it's scrambling to get some diversity. So there's a lesbian who I think is white. You know, she's got the kind of haircut I would see on girls in high school. I'm sure they still rock it now. But her girlfriend, the drummer, is a bald or shaved right. head, we should say, shaved right. head, one-armed black drummer.
Which is like, it feels like a one-armed drummer. It feels like the closest you could be to being a three-legged dog. You know,
yeah, yeah.
like, there you go. Things are tough. Like,
three-legged dogs can do a lot. One-armed yeah. drummer kind of feels more yeah, like just... one-legged DDR player. You know,
okay. It, you know, it's a metaphor because you know she's a black lesbian. So you know yeah. that ceiling's lower. And she's got to shatter it, and so she's got to do it with one arm, and one drumstick.
It's tough, man, because it's like I like the Hobie from Spider-Punk is a black dude, and I like seeing black people depicted in here because like there are black people in the punk scene. A lot of media doesn't get that right,
mm-hmm.
but this character just. I have met disabled black queer women. They exist, right? But you could just feel when it's like a white dude is like trying to like, I don't know, just the fact that they had to cram all the diversity into like it's one true. And a half characters.
Well, it's like, I think this summer or last summer, it was the whole like lesbian disabled hijab wearing person. Like there was like a whole meme about it.
And oh like, yeah, yeah, it's that Memphis art corporate style. I know the exact one.
Okay, mean. Yeah, and it's like I get the criticisms of that stuff, and I think a lot of this book at its core feels like a punk fan who is like, this is what punk is, right? Just like I was doing at the beginning of this episode, and then in the middle of this episode, it's like there's been a big online push about what punk actually is, which you clearly are just like, no, like this, you're not right. Because it's like, yeah, some Nazis like punk. Like, yeah. It's just true. And yeah, the correct thing to do is kill the Nazis. Like, of course, that's what is the morally correct thing to do.
Yeah, there's some great like, punk songs about that.
Yeah, but to say that Nazis aren't punk is also kind of like, well, again.
Well, and to pretend that punk is this progressive thing, like, mm-hmm, I mean, mm-hmm. there are some really terrific progressive bands and progressive people in punk, but like, there's a whole spectrum of politics in punk as there is in any genre of music. And like, I think if you're going to love it, if you're going to say you're about it and you know what it's about, like, you got to accept some of the regressive stuff. Like, I'm not saying embrace it, I'm not saying it's okay, but it's like, you need to acknowledge true. It's there and not yeah. pretend that punk is something it isn't,
right. And it's like, and this is where hope punk exists, right? This is the yeah. end of that line of thinking, is where being a nice person is punk. And it's like, okay. Okay, all right, like, whatever, man. Superman's punk. Okay,
like, yeah, it's weird. It's like, I think one of the deepest rots of our society is the lack of compassion. I think there is something arguably anti-establishment about being a compassionate person. That does not equate to saying that, like, being a really nice, optimistic person is punk. That's a bridge too far.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, like, I think a lot of people like me also kind of like glom onto those definitions that people say for what punk is. And I think a lot of people have done that, right? And it's like, I don't know, it's the thing of, as soon as you overly define a thing, it's no longer cool also. And so it's like, the ephemera is the fun, cool part, the part that you can't necessarily define, the part that is like also very fluid, is part of the design on these things. And so it's also that kind of stuff where it's like, I don't know, man, you know, shitty people like Star Wars a lot. Like, what am I gonna do about that? Like, and yeah, the politics of Star Wars are really stupid. So like, right. It's really easy to glom onto that for people of all kinds of different political backgrounds. And same thing with punk. And like, any kind of movement evolves as you move, and then it splits and it fractures and everything like that too. So it's very much a thing of just like, yeah, man, hope punk. That's punk at the end of the day, I guess. You go, girl. Like,
yeah, I think that was my biggest beef with Toe Tag Riot, is it dips its toes, as it were, a little too far into that for my direction. But like, I can't hate on this thing. Like, they didn't make any money on this. This is clearly a labor of love. You know, good for them.
Yeah, they were having fun with it too.
Yeah,
and it's like, you know what? Whatever. If you want to put a thing out that where they're killing Nazis in a like shitty
I'm
bar
certainly
bathroom,
not against that.
That's great. Yeah, kill Nazis in your comics, and same thing with the Westboro Baptist Church. Go for it. Like, I'm fine with it. It's fine.
Well, that's our last question. Was this one punk?
Sure, man.
Yeah, I'd say it's punk. Well, I hope we've made it clear. Comics being punk or not has no correlation to their quality or their politics. And then I think we've made that clear. Go back, listen to the Sean Murphy episode if you want to hear all my high praise for Sean Murphy and my puzzlement that he didn't knock it out of the park with Punk Rock Jesus.
If you're a Sean Murphy fan, definitely listen to that episode.
Definitely. I mean, we're big Murphy heads, right? We always have.
Yeah, absolutely. Love how he draws cars. He likes cars a lot.
Cars go fast.
Cars. Vroom.
Yeah. Well, we did it. Our bellies are stuffed. We're about to fall asleep on the couch watching football. That's just about the end to think. Punksgiving. I wasn't going to flip that. Thanks for listening to the show. We couldn't do this without you. We would like to keep doing this with more of you. So sub if you haven't already. We got higher tiers for our wealthier friends and cheaper tiers for our paper deficient friends, we will say. So get on the Patreon, get on the Discord, listen to the show, leave a good review if you haven't already. And stay tuned for more sequel season business. Before we head out of here, we've done our part. We've delivered an episode. You've done your part. You've subbed the Patreon or you've left the review. We got one more quick feature we do for you. This is called Taste Maker's Grab Bag, where we recommend to you media and experiences we've enjoyed. And we do it in a sentence or two. Keegan, do you have your grab bag item at the ready?
I do. It's only one today. And it is the feature film Die My Love, starring Robert Pattinson and Jennifer Lawrence. That should be reversed. It's starring Jennifer Lawrence, especially, and Robert Pattinson is definitely the co-star. It rules. I really liked it. It was out of... This is crazy. Get this, okay? I could still go see Frankenstein somewhere near me. One of the independent theaters near me. I could still go see Frankenstein. This movie, by the time I knew it was out, actually, it had already been gone from all my theaters near me. And I'm like, why did that happen? I don't know why that happened. But so we drove a ways to go see it. I'm really happy I did. It was really good. It is a great Mothers Are a Different Thing Than Women movie that I really liked. really liked it. It was great. Jennifer Lawrence is fantastic, and she had to remind everybody that she's one of the best of her generation. So Die My Love, if you can see it in theaters, do it. It's good.
Did you see her film You Were Never Really Here?
No, I've missed a bunch of her movies, so I'm not like a big Jennifer Lawrence head. Like, I like her a lot, but
no, that's by Lynn Ramsey.
I haven't watched any other Lynn Ramsey stuff.
It's fascinating because you know, we were early in the episode making fun of the weird guys who might wear like a kill your local pedophile shirt. And like, this is a movie about like hunting down a pedophile, but it does it in a way that like is not alienating, you know, like the main character is extremely alienated. It's a really bleak film, but like, because there's a sensitivity to like how all the weirdos and psychosis and all of this is handled, you watch it and you have a fair degree of faith that Lynn Ramsey, for as much as she likes to handle dark material, is probably a pretty well-adjusted person.
Yeah, totally. No, I should check it out. I was actually looking at her other, like, the other movies on Letterboxd. I'm like, I should watch a bunch more of these that I've heard good things about. So, eventually.
Well, I also have a feature film. I was recommended Snake Eyes recently by Lan. I watched it. I adored it. And I said, I gotta see more De Palma's. So, I finally watched Blowout. And I loved it. Real great movie making movie. A lot of fun craft stuff, and really good JFK truth psychosis stuff that I always lap up. So go watch both those movies.
Okay.
That's it. Hope you enjoyed your Punksgiving. Thanks for listening, and
keep on grappling.